Alright, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So that is a theme from Creature Features, which aired in the early 70s on Channel 9 in Chicago. It also meant that WGN overnight legends Eddie Schwartz and Steve and Johnny were going to talk about Chicago's most frightening ghost stories in and around Chicagoland with the late Richard Crowe. For hours, they lamented about their ghostly hauntings of places like Bachelor's Grove Cemetery and Archer Avenue and Resurrection Mary, Montrose Point, the old lockup at the Maxwell Street Police Station, and so much more. And a Halloween tradition we started almost 5 years ago is our guest tonight, Ursula Bielski. Ursula is a historian, a parapsychology enthusiast, founder of Chicago Hauntings, hosted PBS's The Hauntings of Chicago. She's been writing and lecturing about Chicago's supernatural for over 20 years. She's recognized as a leading authority on the Chicago's region's ghost lore and cemetery history. She's the author of many popular and critically acclaimed books on the same subject. She grew up in a haunted house on Chicago's north side. And she joins us tonight. Good evening, Ursula.
David, hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Always a pleasure. How you feeling, my dear?
I've been better.
Yeah.
I've been better, but I'm on the mend. Thank you.
You know what it is when it's always that bit? This is your Christmas. This is your holidays.
It is.
So you beat the hell out of your body probably going around doing all the events, and there you have it. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, true.
So you got into this business of the paranormal, but there was some influences in your life that happened because you grew up in a haunted house.
I did. I grew up in a house on the north side of Chicago in North Center, as a matter of fact. My mom still lives there. In fact, this is her 90th birthday today, and she still lives in the house.
Happy birthday to her. Very cool.
Thanks. And, it's one of the houses that was built by my great uncle, Andrew Urbach, who was an architect who helped to develop this area on the north side. And by the time my parents bought the house in 1965, it was really run down. But my mom just had her heart set on this house, and I think it was $14,000 when she first saw it for sale, and my dad said, no way, that refused to spend that much money on this house. But my mom went to the realtor every day, and she watched the price go down. So when it was, I think, $11,000, my dad said, okay. And it was known as the haunted house in the neighborhood when they moved in, and they just thought it was because it was really run down and such.
Sure.
And so forth.
It was more rumor, lore, whatever it
right.
would be.
Yeah. Right. But sure enough, you know, the first night they slept in the house, my dad was a police officer, and he was midnight shift at that time, and my mom was a school teacher, and she was home by herself, and she was woken up in the middle of the night by what sounded like someone running up and down the hallway upstairs. And they had the house had been empty for a while before they bought it, and so they just assumed someone was like squatting in the house, you know, living in the attic or something.
Sure.
So she called the station. I think my dad was at Maxwell Street at that time, and they radioed my dad to go to the house, and he and his partner went through the house from the attic to the basement and found absolutely nothing there. But literally every night for probably 14 or 15 years until the time my brother and I started high school, that happened every single night, whether it was hearing someone running up and down the hall or walking up the staircase. So it was always like we had this other person living with us when I was growing up.
Wow. Wow. So that, I mean, you knew something was real at that time. And what made you actually turn it into a vocation?
Well, I was always interested in it. And, you know, there are a lot of these different stories, not only in my family and other relatives' houses too, but when I started to get older, I started to really learn more about Chicago, and it was through my dad, who had worked in a lot of different police districts and had lived in a lot of different neighborhoods with his family, who was they were Polish immigrants, and so I overheard a lot of ghost stories in all of those different environments growing up, and it was when I got to be a student at Benedictine University in Lyle, in the 80s, that I was fortunate to meet a young man who was studying psychology, and the school allowed him to do a lot of his work in parapsychology. So it was really cool because he let me do a lot of be a research assistant to him, and I got to do a lot of the background research for the field work that he was doing in parapsychology, which was basically investigating ghosts and hauntings. And so that's how I got started as a paranormal investigator. And I worked with him until we graduated, and then in grad school I continued to work on my own, and I was went on to study at Northeastern here in Chicago. I studied religion and the history of parapsychological research. And so I went in that more of that direction of science and folklore and understanding the way people's beliefs and experience all come together. And I really wrote my first book because no one had ever written any of the stories down in Chicago. So right. I never really set out to be a chronicler of the unknown. I did it more of as an historian because I wanted to write these stories down for posterity. And the response to the first book, which was, oh, it's 20 years now.
Wow.
I just had my 20th anniversary of
that.
My first book.
Congrats, yeah.
Thank you, yeah. The response to that first book was so overwhelming that I wrote the second one with stories that were sent to me in response to the first book, and it's been like that ever since. It just keeps going.
You mentioned your Polish heritage, and I'm Polish
right.
as well, and
And
Resurrection Cemetery is where my great grandmother, great grandfathers, and my grandparents are buried. So, you know, we've been there before. We've been there late in the day as dusk has occurred. And, you know, you see these gravestones with little pictures on them, the people that were there that died in the 1920s right. and 30s. I mean, there's some pretty, it's a pretty amazing place. But that is probably the most popular of the ghost stories is that of Resurrection Mary. Why don't we start with her?
She is. Resurrection Mary continues to be Chicago's most famous ghost. And it's not only just Chicago's most famous ghost, but she's a particular type of phantom or piece of folklore, which we call a vanishing hitchhiker or a phantom hitchhiker. And there are literally hundreds of different examples of this kind of a ghost all through history, going back really thousands of years. But she is so popular because all of these other instances of vanishing hitchhikers involve second and third hand accounts of these interactions. You know, my barber's cousin's sister, you know, had this happen. That's not the case with Resurrection Mary. They are first hand accounts where people say, I picked her up on Archer Avenue on a dark night. I tried to give her a ride home. I danced with her at the Willowbrook Ballroom. So there are these eyewitness accounts, and it's very unusual because in particular, there are many of these eyewitness accounts that come from police officers, firefighters, first responders of all kinds. And so they're really reliable eyewitness accounts as well. Probably one of the most unique experiences in all of ghost lore was when Mary left behind what we call a permanent paranormal object, or PPO, as parapsychologists call them. There was a truck driver that was driving past the cemetery about 1 o'clock in the morning in the 1970s, and he saw something out of the corner of his eyes as he passed the gate of Resurrection Cemetery. And it was a young girl that had been locked inside, and she was clutching the bars of the cemetery gate, looking very much afraid. Well, as you mentioned, it's a huge cemetery, and there's actually a sign inside that says, if you get locked in, just wait, someone will come and let you out.
That's encouraging.
And, you know, yeah, well, yeah. But really, almost every day, if you're there just after 5 o'clock, there's a couple cars inside waiting, you know, to be let out. But so he turned the car on, he went to the police station and justice there, and told the cops that there was a girl locked inside. So they called the caretaker to meet them at the gate and to check on this girl and get her home. And when they got to the gate, very famously, there was no one there, but the bars that this girl had been clutching had been mangled, just mangled, and burned into these bronze bars were the imprint of these two, what the police officers described as delicate hands of a child. And now this is before my time. I was probably 8, 9 years old at the time.
Yeah.
But in my career now, I've talked to hundreds of people that went out and saw those bars when they were still there and said that you could actually see the imprint of the fingerprints burned into the metal.
Wow.
Now, those bars were sought out by the cemetery, which, of course, is operated by the Archdiocese of Chicago, and they heated them up and kind of tried to get out those handprints as fast as they could and then brought the bars back and soldered them back into place. 2 weeks later, the spot where the handprints had been became blackened. And so even from the road driving by, you could see where the handprints had been. And no matter how many times the cemetery removed those bars and repaired them and soldered them back into place, you could still see after a couple of weeks that discoloration return. Now, a few years ago, I was driving past the cemetery with a tour group, and lo and behold, the entire front gate is now gold. It used to be that weathered bronze, right? So it's like, wow, the cemetery actually completely replaced the front gate to deter, you know, curiosity seekers who would come to look at these bars and take the pictures of these bars. And it was only, it took me maybe like 3 years until I realized that it's actually the same gate and the bars are still there. They had actually, just spray painted the entire gate.
Is that
gate.
What they did? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So if you go up to the gate, you can still feel, you can still see the seams where it's peeling away, where the bars have been repaired so many times. And you can also put your hands into those bars and still feel a little bit of those indentations of where those handprints were.
What do you want to?
Yeah, Roger Battish in the WGN newsroom. What's the Archdiocese response to any of this? Have they ever come out with some statement? Has anyone ever asked them, or they just kind of leave it alone?
Yeah, they leave it alone, and it is a big, it's a thorn in the side. You know, they put up the barriers every Halloween. Nobody's allowed to come in there. We've been around that area a couple of Saturdays, even in the last year, where we were told in no uncertain terms, like, we have no business there. I know even people going to do research about Mary Bergovi, one of the young women who's believed to perhaps have become Resurrection Mary, you know, this ghost. There, people are deterred from even doing research, genealogical research at the cemetery about her. I just did an interesting talk the other night at St. Mary of the Angels Parish at the invitation of Dan Cheeley, who is one of the radio hosts at Relevant Radio at the Catholic Radio Network in Park Ridge.
Yep.
And he had invited me to speak with him and with Father John over there at St. Mary's about the Catholic Church and belief in ghosts. And we had some interesting conversations. You know, this incident of Mary leaving behind these burnt handprints is not unique in the annals of ghost lore. And I only found this out a few years ago, that there is an entire museum in a little church in Rome that is filled with artifacts of all of this variety. They're all household objects such as books, Bibles, bed sheets, pillowcases, pajamas that have these black handprints on them.
Wow.
And they, each one is accompanied by a little testimony from the person that contributed the artifact that said that when the handprint was made, when the burn mark was made, that they saw the ghost of a loved one that had passed away who had appeared to them asking for prayers to be released from purgatory, of course.
Didn't know that existed. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
And I know a lot of these stories also include, you know, dancing with Mary, like at the Willowbrook Ballroom that burned down last year. And I know there's a there's an effort to rebuild that. There's a nonprofit group looking to raise money to rebuild it, which is fabulous. But the Willowbrook is one of the most haunted places also in Chicago.
It is. The Willowbrook Ballroom is that place, you know, that story of Resurrection Mary always has to do with the young woman who is danced with at a ballroom, you know, back in the 20s or 30s or 40s. And she's very beautiful, very enchanting, very haunting. And all the young men, although no one recognizes who she is, even though everyone's in the neighborhood, no one knows who she is, but they all want to dance with her. They take turns dancing with her, and they all find her cold to the touch and also socially cold. She's very aloof.
I think I dated one of those girls before. Anyway, go ahead.
At the end of the night, though, she becomes very animated, and all of a sudden she's talking to everyone, and she desperately needs a ride home. So, you know, the lucky young man offers her the ride. She gets in the car, and on the way home to the destination, she always says, just drive up Archer, you know, past the cemetery. On the way there, usually in front of the cemetery gates or in front of Chet's Melody Lounge, the old roadhouse across from the cemetery, she either simply vanishes from the car or she says, stop here, and just jumps, throws the car door open and runs through the locked cemetery gate or through the cemetery fence and disappears on the other side. But those incidences of dancing with her, the owners of the Willowbrook told me, we had our paranormal conference there just 2 weeks before the fire happened last year. As you said, burned down, completely burned down. And the owners were talking to me at our event about the fact that even over the summer last year, there were people who had the experience of dancing with this woman who then disappeared.
Now that did that stop when the Willowbrook burned down, or has it been a while since we've had the last reports of that?
Now, I have not personally heard any reports of encounters with Resurrection Mary in this past year. Since that happened. Now, that's not unusual. Probably the last encounter that was told to me personally probably happened about 2 years ago.
Okay. All right.
So we'll see. We were all wondering, like, she's probably very confused, She's probably very confused, doesn't know what's going on. And we've had these incidences in the past where there were changes that happened along Archer Avenue or at the cemetery, where she did appear more frequently and did appear to be confused. There was a spate of appearances in the 1980s where she was picked up much more frequently, especially in the winter time around 1983, 84, 85. And she appeared very frazzled, very confused, was much more talkative or animated than she normally was. And some researchers have suggested that this may have coincided with the term of her grave coming up. If she did pass away and was interred in the early 1930s, and she was in a half-term grave. Now, this is, usually a grave is rented for 100 years.
Oh.
But during that, and then at that point, if there's no family around or if someone doesn't want to renew it, the headstone is taken off and it's reused again. We often hear stories like this. Even Manuel says, I know when we've tried to inter family members in the last 10 or 20 years, they've discovered that there's someone down there and they have to, you know, make arrangements for that. But in the Great Depression, oftentimes because people did not have the resources to buy a grave for a whole term, they would be leased for half term or 50 years.
You know, there was a cemetery about a year and a half ago or two where they found bodies buried on top of other bodies in the same grave.
Right.
That they were reusing those graves.
Yeah. This is at Burr Oak Cemetery in Alsip.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
this is a horrific situation, I think. And, you know, Sheriff Tom Dart, he's wonderful. And they discovered something like that there was grave space in that cemetery for something like 600,000 bodies. And there were more than that had been buried there, and they hadn't even used the majority of the graves.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So this had been going on for something like 15 or 20 years, where the management of the cemeteries was just reselling graves for cash.
Well, we're going to talk more with Ursula. We've got so many great stories to tell. We'll talk about some of those cemeteries and Congress Hotel and Marshall Fields and so much more. Stick around. We'll be right back after the news next on 720 WGN. All right, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Ursula Bielski about haunted Chicago and Chicago's legendary ghost stories in and around town. So, Ursula, what is the most haunted cemetery in Chicago? Most stories.
Oh, without a doubt, Bachelor's Grove Cemetery in suburban Oak Forest. This is around 143rd Street and Ridgeland. This is an old settler cemetery that was established just after the Black Hawk War, you know, around 1832. Mm-hmm. And there were two waves of settlers that settled the cemetery. There was a first wave of English immigrants that were really squatters in the area, and then German farmers that came into the area. This whole area was, it was really all sold off. I mean, this was a thriving farm community, but it was all sold to the Forest Reserve District of Cook County, you know, in the 1920s, or when the first last homesteaders left. And there were a lot of different circumstances that went into the problems with Bachelor's Grove. But basically, we ended up having a situation starting in the 1930s and through the 40s and 50s and 60s where the area really became abandoned and the cemetery became very vandalized. And then you also had a portion of time where there was a lot of ritual activity in the neighborhood that probably was a result of the ghost stories that had started. So you have what the late, great Richard Crowe used to call the layer cake effect, where you have, you know, the vandalism that starts, maybe a murder that happens, desecration that begins, more ghost stories, ritual activity, more ghostly goings on, more ghost stories, and you come to the point where you don't know which came first, you know, the chicken or the egg.
Right, yeah.
If the ghost stories came first or the actual incidents came first. But it's amazing. You know, one of my more recent books, Haunted Bachelor's Grove, came out last year with History Press, and it's over 200 pages just about Bachelor's Grove. And it continues to hold so much appeal for people. There's so many experiences that people have. There's a vanishing house, vanishing cars, a woman in white that is seen walking through the cemetery, they say, searching for her baby. All sorts of strange lights that are seen in the woods and in the cemetery. I was just out there earlier today. There was a very rare event that was held by the Forest Preserve District in which they allowed people to come into the cemetery and into the preserve around it. After dusk, normally it's closed after dusk. Mm-hmm. And I thought there would be several hundred people there. There were several thousand people that came out to this event. It was crazy. I mean, I've never seen anything like it anywhere. But that's the appeal that Bachelor's Grove has. And it's really with good reason. There's a lot of strange things that go on there. And I've experienced a number of those myself over the years.
And what is, give me some of the, what is like the most famous story coming out of Bachelor's Grove?
Probably the most famous story coming out of the Bachelor's Grove is the story of, I would say, of this vanishing house. I mean, there's there's a lot of other stories that are told, but I would say that's one of the most unique phenomena that you will find when you're talking about supernatural phenomena around the world. People going back until at least the 1950s have talked about seeing this white farmhouse in all different parts of the area on either side of the path that goes back there, the old Midlothian Turnpike, inside the cemetery, in the forest preserve, across the creek that runs through there. So all different places. People talk about seeing the house, but when they start to approach it, it gets smaller and smaller. It gets further and further away from them and then disappears altogether. Many people talk about when they see this house that there is, very interestingly, a malevolent feeling that they get from the house, almost like the house is menacing. And I've heard numerous people, including fellow investigators who've seen the house, talk about, in addition to the menacing feeling, the feeling that whatever is creating this image of the house is happy that it is putting fear into people. So it's like there's something in the woods that's creating these apparitions and is frightening people on purpose and enjoying frightening people. And again, I've heard many investigators tell me, I know this sounds crazy, but I saw this house and I felt like it was trying to scare me. And when I got scared, that it was glad it scared me.
Wow.
So this is a very unusual thing that you have coming out of here. And most investigators believe that this menacing feeling or this malevolent feeling is not coming from the people that are interred in the cemetery. These are good people, farmers and people who built up Tinley Park and Bremen Township. You know, good, hardworking people that had a lot of difficulties in life, as everyone at that time did, you know. But that there is something in the woods that surround Bachelor's Grove Cemetery that is malevolent, whether it comes from, some people think it comes from white settlers encroaching on Native American lands. Some people think it comes from a curse that was put on the land. Some people think it comes from that ritual activity in the 60s and 70s. I don't know where it comes from, but I truly believe that there is something there.
I say you've felt it. You've experienced it yourself.
I have. I was out in those woods about, a handful of years now. It was in June of 2012. It was a couple of weeks after Richard Crowe passed away. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had met a steward of the cemetery at Richard Crowe, after Richard Crowe's funeral, at Chetsability Lounge. We were gathered there having Bloody Marys in Richard's honor. And I had known this young man before, and I knew that he had done a lot of stewardship at the cemetery, but I hadn't really talked to him. And he invited me to come out to the cemetery in a couple of weeks for a tour. So I went out, and we spent several hours on this very hot afternoon walking through the cemetery and also touring a lot of old home sites in the area where you can still see remains of the old house foundations and so forth. And then it got to be dusk, and we went out to dinner. And then after dinner, it was quite dark, and he asked if I wanted to go back. And since he worked with the Forest Preserve District, no listener should go there after dark. It's strictly off limits.
Yeah.
But I went back with him, and we walked through the woods, and we spent some time in the cemetery talking about the history of the place again, a very, very hot, humid night. And then we went to walk back through the woods to our cars that were parked over on 147th Street. And we wandered around for about an hour and a half. And this is the young man who had, he estimated that he had been there about 2,000 times over the last 15 years. He had marked and mapped all the trails behind the cemetery in the woods there. And after about an hour and a half, he finally had to admit to me that he was lost.
Oh, wow.
And we wandered around for about three more hours in that little bit of woods around the cemetery, totally disoriented, turned around. The GPS signals on our phones failed. We weren't able to call anyone. We weren't able to text anyone. And Dave, we saw lights of houses and lights of cars and we would walk towards them thinking we had gotten to the road.
Sure.
And they would just vanish. Like we would hear cars going by and see the lights of the cars going by and the houses across the road. And then as we approached them, it was like being swallowed up by a vacuum.
Wow.
And it happened over and over and over every 15 or 20 minutes to the point where we finally realized that there was some intelligent something there that was manipulating the environment to deceive us, disorient us, tire us out. And then we started to get that feeling, too, that it was enjoying
it was satisfying.
Having that effect
yeah.
on us. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you mentioned Richard Crowe. Do you remember the first show you and I did together? It was about 5 years ago. And we were in the studio.
Sure.
Yeah, and we were talking about the traditions,
yeah.
right? Okay, you know this. So we were talking about the traditions on WGN that, you know, these overnight shows around Halloween and between Eddie Schwartz and Stephen Johnny and even Wally Phillips in the morning show would talk about all these
sure.
great haunted
yeah.
places. And as you started talking about Richard, the lights in the studio very awkwardly above the board just started
yes.
blinking.
Yeah,
right?
I remember that very clearly.
And I'm not kidding. I mean, this is not just for lore. That was it freaked
true
us
story.
Out. It freaked out my producer at the time too, but we felt kind of like they were hanging out with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. 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 Great stories. The 773 texter, hi, Dave, isn't the Congress Hotel supposed to be haunted? They're asking if it's haunted by Al Capone.
Oh, my gosh. This place has gotten so much press in the last few weeks. It appeared, I think it was about a month ago, Dave, there was some list. There's some news story where somebody voted. I don't know who voted. But the Congress Plaza Hotel in Chicago, the most haunted place in Illinois. This news story and this story was picked up by like everybody
yeah.
and spread all over everywhere. So the Congress Plaza Hotel has been like on every podcast and everything over the last few weeks. It's an interesting place. This is a place on Michigan Avenue right across from Buckingham Fountain. It was built to take in visitors to the World's Fair of 1893. It's a very old building. There's about 900 rooms in the two towers. Very, very interesting place. I've stayed there, I think, four nights, and on every night had a harrowing experience in my room. Al Capone is one of the people that it is believed haunts the Congress. He used to play cards in one of the meeting rooms that overlooks Grant Park.
Huh, okay.
So every Friday night he would play cards in there. And, you know, it's believed that this is one of the places where he remained behind. And there are actually a lot of guys that worked with him that lived in the Congress Hotel. And very famously, there were phone calls that were called into Al Capone down in Florida from the Congress Hotel on the night of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre of 1929. So there's a lot of gangland connections with the Congress Hotel.
I'm not kidding you. I'm listening to something in the background of my headphones that sounds kind of creepy. Do you hear that, Camille, in there? Did you hear that?
I think it was me. Sorry. No, I'm trying to find some
It
audio.
Was freaking me out.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, man. Don't do that to me right now, man.
Yep.
That's awesome. sorry, I didn't mean to pause there. I was totally listening and then I got totally freaked out. Let's see here. It says, does Ursula know, from 773, the house by the area where the Grimes sisters' bodies were found? Do you know anything about
right,
that?
Right. Yeah, very famously, there is a house. This is on German Church Road near Wolf Road in Willow Springs. And this was the location where very, very sadly and very infamously the bodies of the Grimes sisters were found. Of course, they just disappeared in the winter mm-hmm. in 1956. And this remains an unsolved case today. But, you know, there's all sorts of legends about that area where they were found near Devil's Creek. And there was a house there that was abandoned. It was like a family left the food in the refrigerator, food on the table, dinner on the table, car in the driveway. And it was always purported that whoever killed the Grimes sisters had some contact with his family, and the family thought they would be implicated in it and left. It's a very mysterious location. The house is gone now. I have never been able to find out anything more about who owned the house, who, what the circumstances were about these people who left. And yet that location is still one where I continue to collect stories that people still occasionally email me or call me and tell me that they are having the experience. It's always an audible experience of cars tearing through that site, the sound of a car trunk slamming as if like someone's dropping something in the road and then slamming the trunk. So, yeah, it's still kind of an actively haunted site, but that house continues to be the thing most people talk about. So I welcome any knowledge anybody has about any more details about it.
Can you stick around for one more segment?
Of course.
Okay, we're going to do Marshall Fields and a couple other places. And then I also want to talk to you about your tours because you've got a lot going on, obviously, through Halloween and beyond. And we'll talk about that with Ursula Bielski. And we've got more next on 720 WGN. All right, it's Dave Plyer live from the Allstate Showcase Studios right here on 720 WGN. We're talking about Haunted Chicago with Ursula Bielski of Chicago Hauntings. Ursula, I love the story about Marshall Fields because, you know, this is, and this is the Macy's on State Street that we're talking about, that I believe it's the eighth floor, and forgive me if I'm wrong on that, but the eighth floor is haunted, and people, you know, I think I told you that when I was shopping for furniture there some years ago, I was always feeling like cool breezes and just awkward, like a thudness about being up there. Just, it felt kind of, you know, dead air kind of up there. And that was all as a result of the Iroquois Theater fire, correct?
It was. That, and it's so funny. So it's so true. I want to say it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I got a beautiful handwritten letter from a woman who is now almost 100, and she had come to Chicago, of course, many, many years ago as a young woman, and she was looking for work. And she it was right before the holiday season, and she had gotten one of these coveted positions at Marshall Fields for the holidays as a sales girl. And she was so excited. She was so grateful. She thought she just, you know, she was her lucky day. And she went to her first day of work, and the manager took her up to her locker, which was on the eighth floor at the time, where all of the employee lockers and the lunchroom was. And she said, you know, here's your locker. Put your coat away, and then we'll go downstairs. And she put her coat away, and they went down, and she did her first morning of training and went up to get her coat to go take a walk at lunch, and she just never went back. And she said that she could not fathom going up and putting her coat in that locker every day. She could not go up to that floor. She knew it instantly. She said she couldn't put her finger on it, didn't know what it was. She just said that it was this overwhelming feeling of oppression on that floor. Now, that floor, as you mentioned, is completely tied to the Iroquois Theater fire. This is the fire that happened on December 30th, 1903, at the Iroquois Theater, which had only been open for about 6 weeks at the time of fire. This is right on Randolph Street where the Oriental Theater is today. That theater was the location of one of the worst disasters in American history. In fact, to this day, it's the worst single building fire in American history. And that was a fire that led to 602 people dying in this fire. very sadly, it was overwhelmingly school children and their chaperones because it was the Christmas holidays. Yeah. And this, you know, everybody knows about this fire around the world because it led to all of these sweeping changes in fire codes. So we all have ordinances around the world where public buildings have to have doors that open outwards rather than inwards. We have to have illuminated exit signs over the doors and things like this, all because of the Iroquois Theater fire, because all of these things were not in place when the fire happened. Now, there were a number of people that died inside the building, of course, but there were also many people that died outside in the alley behind the building, which is still called Death Alley today because of there were about 125 people who died in the alley. And this is a big place for people to take ghost tours and so forth, now known as very haunted location. But after the fire, the eighth floor of Marshall Field and Company, now Macy's, was used as a temporary morgue and a hospital because of the elevators in the building, which was unusual at the time, and also the abundance of bedding, towels, sheets that could be used not only to dress wounds, but also to wrap the dead. And so that eighth floor was a very traumatic place for many hours. And it's weird. It's got this reputation today. I've talked to so many people over the years who have worked in the building who talk about this pall that hangs over that floor. And yeah, I mean, you know, I never knew this stuff when I was a kid going up there. Right. We used to always love to go up there because they had the furniture up there, you know.
Right. And you can see the tree from
the
up
rooms.
There. Yeah.
But there was always that weird, strange feeling up there.
Yeah.
You know, also that, you know, it's an atrium building, and there have been numerous suicides from the eighth floor in that building. In fact, just the last one, I only found out about the last one a few years ago because it happened, I think, in July. I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, there was actually a woman on our bus who worked there who came on our bus tour and told us that there had been this man who came into the store just before closing time, and he had bought a white suit, white shirt, white tie, white hat, white pocket square, white socks, the whole bit, put it all on in the men's room, went up to the eighth floor and threw himself over the atrium rail. And now there are these plexiglass additions up, so you can't do that anymore. But the suicides are numerous in the building. And, you know, there's at least a legend in the store that they're all from that floor because of that oppressive feeling on that floor that literally, like, drives people over the edge.
And so much of what you're talking about, and you have tours that you do, which are amazing. I mean, you got a ton of different experiences that you offer throughout the year. But what do you got coming up today through Halloween and All Souls Day coming up through Chicago Hauntings?
Yeah, we've got so many tours still left. It's been a very busy season. I think we ran something like 12 tours today, for example.
Wow.
But we still have tours tomorrow. Our bus tour is, we've been in business for 15 years. Our original Chicago Hauntings bus tour departs from the famous and fabled Concourse Plaza Hotel. Tomorrow evening we have two tours. I think one is still open for available seats. Mm-hmm. And then on Monday night, Devil's Night, the night before Halloween, we have two tours departing. And then on Halloween night, of course, we have a tour. And then, yes, All Souls Day on Wednesday, All Saints Day, or rather All Saints Day on Wednesday, All Souls Day on Thursday and next weekend. And I think we still have a few seats too tomorrow for our Devil in the White City tour
at
2 p.m. So, yeah, and that's all those are available at chicagohauntings.com. You can see the whole calendar by clicking any one of the Book Now links.
Very cool. And I got to tell you, always I look forward to talking to you around this time of year. It's you've got the best stories,
thank you, David,
and feel better. And we're really looking forward to the rest of your tours. And again,
sorry for my voice.
Oh no, not at all, not at all. So ChicagoHauntings.com again to catch any of these tours, and still available some of them through Halloween and throughout the week. Thanks again, dear.
Thanks, Dave. Happy Halloween to you.
Same to you as well.